He kissed her, and she reached for him, her eyes still closed. "You're a frog, and I'll make you a prince," she said in a sleep-filled voice. "Or is it the other way around?" As expanding as it may be, that's not in my present frame of reference. "Then you'll have to stay a frog. Hop around, little frog. Show off for me." "No temptations. I only hop when I'm fed flies."
"Frogs eat flies?"
"I guess they do."
"Shudder. That's awful."
"Come on, open your eyes. We've both got to start hopping. We've got to start hunting." She blinked and looked at him.
"Hunting for what?"
"For me," he said. From a telephone booth on the Rue Lafayette, a collect call was placed to a number in Zurich by a Mr. Briggs. Bourne reasoned that Jacqueline Lavier would have wasted no time sending out her alarms. One had to have been flashed to Zurich. When he heard the ring in Switzerland, Jason stepped back and handed the phone to Marie. She knew what to say. She had no chance to say it. The international operator in Zurich came on the line.
"We regret that the number you have called is no longer in service."
"It was the other day," broke in Marie.
"This is an emergency, operator. Do you have another number?"
"The telephone is no longer in service, madame. There is no alternate number."
"I may have been given the wrong one. It's most urgent. Could you give me the name of the party who had this number?"
"I'm afraid that's not possible."
"I told you, it's an emergency. May I speak with your superior, please?"
"He would not be able to help you. This number is an unpublished listing. Good afternoon, madame." The connection was broken.
"It's been disconnected," she said.
"It took too goddamn long to find that out," replied Bourne, looking up and down the street. "Let's get out of here."
"You think they could have traced it here? In Paris? To a public phone?"
"Within 3 minutes, an exchange can be determined, a district pinpointed. In 4, they can narrow the blocks down to 6.
"How do you know that?"
"I wish I could tell you. Let's go."
"Jason, why not wait out of sight? And watch?"
"Because I don't know what to watch for, and they do. They've got a photograph to go by. They could station men all over the area."
"I don't look anything like the picture in the papers." "Not you. Me. Let's go."
They walked rapidly within the erratic ebb and flow of the crowds until they reached the Boulevard Malesherbes, 10 blocks away, and another telephone booth, this with a different exchange from the first. This time there were no operators to go through. This was Paris. Marie stepped inside, coins in her hand, and dialed. She was prepared. But the words that came over the line so astonished her.
"La résidence du général Villiers? Bonjour?
Hello? Hello?" For a moment, Marie was unable to speak. She simply stared at the telephone.
"Je m'excuse," she whispered. "Une erreur."
She hung up.
"What's the matter?"
asked Bourne, opening the glass door. "What happened? Who was it?"
"It doesn't make sense," she said. "I just reached the house of one of the most respected and powerful men in France."
Chapter 24
"André-François Villiers,"
repeated Marie, lighting a cigarette. They had returned to their room at the terrasse to sort things out, to absorb the astonishing information.
"Graduate of Saint-Cyr, hero of the Second World War, a legend in the resistance, and until his break over Algeria, de Gaulle's heir apparent. Jason, to connect such a man with Carlos is simply unbelievable."
"The connection's there. Believe it."
"It's almost too difficult. Villiers is old line honor of France, a family traced back to the 17th century. Today he's one of the ranking deputies in the National Assembly. Politically to the right of Charlemagne, to be sure, but very much a law-and-order army man. It's like linking Douglas MacArthur to a mafia hitman. It doesn't make sense."
"Then let's look for some. What was the break with de Gaulle?"
"Algeria. In the early 60s, Villiers was part of the OAS, one of the Algerian colonels under Salan. They opposed the Evian agreements that gave independence to Algeria, believing it rightfully belonged to France.
The mad colonels of Algiers, said Bourne, as with so many words and phrases, not knowing where they came from or why he said them.
That means something to you?
It must, but I don't know what it is.
Think,
said Marie. Why should the mad colonels strike a chord with you? What's the first thing that comes to your mind? Quickly. Jason looked at her helplessly. Then the words came. Bombings. Infiltrations. Provocateurs. You study them. You study the mechanisms.
Why?
I don't know.
Are decisions based on what you learn?
I guess so.
What kind of decisions? You decide what?
Disruptions.
What does that mean to you, disruptions?
I don't know. I can't think.
All right. All right. We'll go back to it some other time.
There isn't time. Let's get back to Villiers. After Algeria, what?
There was a reconciliation of sorts with de Gaulle. Villiers was never directly implicated in the terrorism, and his military record demanded it. He returned to France. He was welcomed, really. A fighter for a lost but respected cause. He resumed his command, rising to the rank of general, before going into politics.
He's a working politician, then.
More a spokesman. An elder statesman.
He's still an entrenched militarist, still fumes over France's reduced military stature.
Howard Leland, said Jason. There's your connection to Carlos.
How? Why?
Leland was assassinated because he interfered with Aquis d'Orsay's arms build-ups and exports. We don't need anything more.
It seems incredible. A man like that?
Marie's voice trailed off. She was struck by recollection.
His son was murdered. It was a political thing, about 5 or 6 years ago.
Tell me.
His car was blown up on the Rue de Bac. It was in all the papers everywhere. He was the working politician, like his father, a conservative, opposing the socialists and communists at every turn. He was a young member of parliament, an obstructionist where government expenditures were concerned, but actually quite popular. He was a charming aristocrat.
Who killed him?
The speculation was communist fanatics. He'd managed to block some legislation or other favorable to the extreme left wing. After he was murdered, the ranks fell apart and the legislation passed. Many think that's why Villiers left the army and stood for the National Assembly. That's what's so improbable, so contradictory. After all, his son was assassinated. You'd think the last person on earth he'd want to have anything to do with was a professional assassin.
There's also something else. You said he was welcomed back to Paris because he was never directly implicated in the terrorism.
If he was, interrupted Marie, it was buried. They are more tolerant of passionate causes over here where country and the bed are concerned. And he was a legitimate hero, don't forget that.
But once a terrorist, always a terrorist. Don't you forget that.
I can't agree. People change.
Not about some things. No terrorist ever forgets how effective he's been. He lives on it.
How would you know that?
I'm not sure I want to ask myself right now.
Then don't.
But I am sure about Villiers. I'm going to reach him. Bourne crossed to the bedside table and picked up the telephone book. Let's see if he's listed or if that number's private. I'll need his address.
You won't get near him. If he's Carlos' connection, he'll be guarded. They'll kill you on sight. They have your photograph, remember?
It won't help them. I won't be what they're looking for. Here it is. Villiers, AF. Parc Monceau.
I still can't believe it. Just knowing whom she was calling must have put the Lavieille woman in shock.
Or frightened her to the point where she'd do anything.
Doesn't it strike you as odd that she'd be given that number?
Not under the circumstances. Carlos wants his drones to know he isn't kidding. He wants Kane.
Marie stood up.
Jason, what's a drone?
Bourne looked up at her.
I don't know.
Someone who works blind for somebody else.
Blind? Not seeing?
Not knowing. Thinking he's doing one thing when he's really doing something else.
I don't understand.
Let's say I tell you to watch for a car at a certain street corner. The car never shows up. But the fact that you're there tells someone else who's watching for you that something else has happened.
Arithmetically, an untraceable message.
Yes, I guess so.
That's what happened in Zurich. Walter Apfel was a drone. He released that story about the theft not knowing what he was really saying.
Which was?
It's a good guess that you are being told to reach someone you know very well.
Treadstone 71, said Jason. We're back to Villiers. Carlos found me in Zurich through the Gemeinschaft. That means he had to know about Treadstone. It's a good chance that Villiers does, too. If he doesn't, there may be a way of getting him to find out for us.
How?
His name. If he's everything you say he is, he thinks pretty highly of it. The honor of France, coupled with a pig like Carlos, might have an effect. I'll threaten to go to the police, to the papers.
He'd simply deny it. He'd say it's outrageous.
Let him. It isn't. That was his number in Lavier's office. Besides, any retraction will be on the same page as his obituary.
You still have to get to him?
I will. I'm part chameleon, remember? The tree-lined street in Parc Monceau seemed familiar somehow, but not in the sense that he had walked it before. Instead, it was the atmosphere. Two rows of well-kept stone houses, doors and windows glistening, hardware shining, staircases washed clean, the lighted rooms beyond filled with hanging plants. It was a moneyed street in a wealthy section of the city, and he knew he had been exposed to one like it before, and that exposure had meant something. It was 7:35 in the evening, the March night cold, the sky clear, and the chameleon dressed for the occasion. Bourne's blonde hair was covered by a cap, his neck concealed beneath the collar of a jacket that spelled out the name of a messenger service across his back. Slung over his shoulder was a canvas strap attached to a nearly empty satchel. It was the end of this particular messenger's run. He had two or three stops to make, perhaps four or five, if he thought they were necessary. He would know momentarily. The envelopes were not really envelopes at all, but brochures advertising the pleasures of the Bateau Mouche, picked up from a hotel lobby. He would select at random several houses near General Villiers' residence and deposit the brochures in mail slots. His eyes would record everything they saw, one thing sought above everything else. What kind of security arrangements did Villiers have? Who guarded the general, and how many were there? And because he had been convinced he would find either men in cars or other men walking their posts, he was startled to realize there was no one. André-François Villiers, militarist, spokesman for his cause, and the prime connection to Carlos, had no external security arrangements whatsoever. If he was protected, that protection was solely within the house. Considering the enormity of his crime, Villiers was either arrogant to the point of carelessness or a damn fool. Jason climbed the steps of an adjacent residence, Villiers' door no more than 20 feet away. He deposited the brochure in the slot, glancing up at the windows of Villiers' house, looking for a face, a figure. There was no one. The door 20 feet away suddenly opened. Bourne crouched, thrusting his hand beneath his jacket for his gun, thinking he was a damn fool. Someone more observant than he had spotted him. But the words he heard told him it wasn't so. A middle-aged couple, a uniformed maid, and a dark-jacketed man were talking in the doorway.
"Make sure the ashtrays are clean," said the woman. "You know how he dislikes ashtrays that are stuffed full."
"He drove this afternoon," answered the man. "That means they're full now." playing them in the garage. You've got time. He won't be down for another 10 minutes. He doesn't have to be in Nanterre until 8:30.
The man nodded, pulling up the lapels of his jacket as he started down the steps.
10 minutes, he said aimlessly.
The door closed and silence returned the quiet street. Jason stood up, his hand on the railing, watching the man hurry down the sidewalk. He was not sure where Nanterre was, only that it was a suburb of Paris. And if Villiers was driving there himself, and if he was alone, there was no point in postponing confrontation.
Bourne shifted the strap on his shoulder and walked rapidly down the steps, turning left on the pavement. 10 minutes.
Jason watched through the windshield as the door opened and General of the Army André-François Villiers came into view. He was a medium-sized, barrel-chested man in his late 60s, perhaps early 70s. He was hatless, with close-cropped gray hair and a meticulously groomed white chin beard. His bearing was unmistakably military, imposing his body on the surrounding space, entering it by breaking it, invisible walls collapsing as he moved. Bourne stared at him, fascinated, wondering what insanities could have possibly driven such a man into the obscene world of Carlos. Whatever the reasons, they had to be powerful, for he was powerful. And that made him dangerous, for he was respected and had the ears of his government. Villiers turned, speaking to the maid and glancing at his wristwatch. The woman nodded, closing the door, as the general walked briskly down the steps and around the hood of a large sedan to the driver's side. He opened the door and climbed in, then started the engine and rolled slowly out into the middle of the street. Jason waited until the sedan reached the corner and turned right. He eased the Renault away from the curb and accelerated, reaching the intersection in time to see Villiers turn right again a block east. There was a certain irony in the coincidence. An omen if one could believe in such things. The route General Villiers chose to the outlying suburb of Nanterre included a stretch of back road in the countryside nearly identical to the one in Saint-Germain-en-Laye, where 12 hours ago Marie had pleaded with Jason not to give up, his life or hers. There were stretches of pasture land, fields that fused into the gently rising hills, but instead of being crowned by early light, these were washed in the cold, white rays of the moon. It occurred to Bourne that this stretch of isolated road would be as good a spot as any on which to intercept the returning general. It was not difficult for Jason to follow at distances up to a quarter of a mile, which was why he was surprised to realize he had practically caught up with the old soldier. Villiers had suddenly slowed down and was turning into a graveled drive cut out of the woods, the parking lot beyond illuminated by floodlights. A sign, hanging from two chains on a high-angle post, was caught in the spill. L'Arbalète. The general was meeting someone for dinner at an out-of-the-way restaurant. Not in the suburb of Nanterre, but close by. In the country. Bourne drove past the entrance and pulled off the shoulder of the road, the right side of the car covered by foliage. He had to think things out. He had to control himself. There was a fire in his mind. It was growing, spreading. He was suddenly consumed by an extraordinary possibility. Considering the shattering events, the enormity of the embarrassment experienced by Carlos last night at the motel in Montrouge, it was more than likely that André Villiers had been summoned to an out-of-the-way restaurant for an emergency meeting. Perhaps even with Carlos himself. If that was the case, the premises would be guarded, and a man whose photograph had been distributed to those guards would be shot the instant he was recognized. On the other hand, the chance to observe a nucleus belonging to Carlos, or Carlos himself, was an opportunity that might never come again. He had to get inside L'Arbalète. There was a compulsion within him to take the risk. Any risk. It was crazy. But then he was not sane. Sane as a man with a memory was sane. Carlos. Find Carlos. God in heaven, why? He felt the gun in his belt. It was secure. He got out and put on his topcoat, covering the jacket with the lettering across the back. He picked up a narrow-brimmed hat from the seat,
the cloth soft, angled down all sides. It would cover his hair. Then he tried to remember if he had been wearing the tortoiseshell glasses when the photograph was taken in Argenteuil. He had not. He had removed them at the table when successive bolts of pain had seared through his head, brought on by words that told him of a past too familiar, too frightening to face. He felt his shirt pocket. The glasses were there if he needed them. He pressed the door closed and started for the woods. The glare of the restaurant floodlights filtered through the trees, growing brighter with each several yards, less foliage to block the light. Bourne reached the edge of the short patch of forest, the graveled parking lot in front of him. He was at the side of the rustic restaurant, a row of small windows running the length of the building, flickering candles beyond the glass illuminating the figures of the diners. Then his eyes were drawn to the second floor. Although it did not extend the length of the building, but only halfway, the rear section an open terrace. The enclosed part, however, was similar to the first floor. A line of windows, a bit larger perhaps, but still in a row, and again glowing with candles. Figures were milling about, but they were different from the diners below. They were all men, standing, not sitting. Moving casually, glasses in hands, cigarette smoke spiraling over their heads. It was impossible to tell how many. More than 10, less than 20, perhaps. There he was, crossing from one group to another, the white chin beard a beacon, switching on and off as it was intermittently blocked by figures nearer the windows. General Villiers had indeed driven out to Nanterre for a meeting, and the odds favored a conference that dealt with the failures of the past 48 hours, failures that permitted a man named Cain to remain alive. The odds. What were the odds? Where were the guards? How many, and where were their stations? Keeping behind the edge of the woods, Bourne sidestepped his way toward the front of the restaurant, bending branches silently, his feet over the underbrush. He stood motionless, watching for men concealed in the foliage or in the shadows of the building. He saw none and retraced his path, breaking new ground until he reached the rear of the restaurant. A door opened, the spill of light harsh, and a man in a white jacket emerged. He stood for a moment, cupping his hands, lighting a cigarette. Bourne looked to the left, to the right, above to the terrace. No one appeared. A guard stationed in the area would have been alarmed by the sudden light 10 feet below the conference. There were no guards outside. Protection found, as it had to be at Villiers' house in Parc Monceau, within the building itself. Another man appeared in the doorway, also wearing a white jacket, but with the addition of a chef's hat. His voice was angry, his French laced with the guttural dialect of Gascony.
"How you piss off, we sweat. The pastry cart is half empty. Fill it. Now, you bastard."
The pastry man turned and shrugged. He crushed out his cigarette and went back inside, closing the door behind him. The light vanished. Only the wash of the moon remained, but it was enough to illuminate the terrace. There was no one there, no guard patrolling the wide double doors that led to the inside room. Carlos. Find Carlos. Trap Carlos. Cain is for Charlie, and Delta is for Cain. Bourne judged the distance and the obstacles. He was no more than 40 feet from the rear of the building, 10 or 12 below the railing that bordered the terrace. There were 2 vents in the exterior wall, vapor escaping from both, and next to them a drain pipe that was within reach of the railing. If he could scale the pipe and manage to get a toehold in the lower vent, he would be able to grab a rung of the railing and pull himself up to the terrace. But he could do none of this wearing the topcoat. He took it off, placing it at his feet, the soft-brimmed hat on top, and covered both with underbrush. Then he stepped to the edge of the woods and raced as quietly as possible across the gravel to the drainpipe. In the shadows he tugged at the fluted metal. It was strongly in place. He reached as high as he could, then sprang up, gripping the pipe, his feet pressed into the wall, pedaling one on top of the other until his left foot was parallel to the first vent. Holding on, he slipped his foot into the recess and propelled himself further up the drain. He was within 18 inches of the railings. One surge launched from the vent, and he could reach the bottom rung. The door crashed open beneath him, white light shooting across the gravel into the woods. A figure plummeted out, weaving to maintain its balance, followed by the white-hatted chef who was screaming.
You pissant! You're drunk, that's what you are! You've been drunk the whole shit-filled night! Pastries all over the dining room floor, everything amiss! Get out! You'll not get a sou!
The door was pulled shut, the sound of a bolt unmistakably final. Jason held on to the pipe, arms and ankles aching, rivulets of sweat breaking out on his forehead. The man below staggered backward, making obscene gestures repeatedly with his right hand for the benefit of the chef who was no longer there. His glazed eyes wandered up the wall, settling on Bourne's face. Jason held his breath as their eyes met. The man stared, then blinked and stared again. He shook his head, closing his lids, then opened them wide, taking in the sight he was not entirely sure was there. He backed away, lurching into a sideslip and a forward walk, obviously deciding that the apparition halfway up the wall was the result of his pressured labors. He weaved around the corner of the building, a man more at peace with himself for having rejected the foolishness that had assaulted his eyes. Bourne breathed again, letting his body slump against the wall in relief. But it was only for a moment. The ache in his ankle had descended to his foot, a cramp forming. He lunged, grabbing the iron bar that was the base of the railing with his right hand, whipping his left up from the drainpipe, joining it. He pressed his knees into the shingles and pulled himself slowly up the wall until his head was over the edge of the terrace. It was deserted. He kicked his right leg up to the ledge, his right hand reaching for the wrought iron top. Balanced, he swung over the railing. He was on a terrace used for dining in the spring and summer months, a tiled floor that could accommodate 10 to 15 tables. In the center of the wall separating the enclosed section from the terrace were the wide double doors he had seen from the woods. The figures inside were now motionless, standing still. And for an instant Jason wondered whether an alarm had been set off, whether they were waiting for him. He stood immobile, his hand on his gun. Nothing happened. He approached the wall, staying in the shadows. Once there, he pressed his back against the wood and edged his way toward the first door until his fingers touched the frame. Slowly, he inched his head to the pane of glass, level with his eyes, and looked inside. What he saw was both mesmerizing and not a little frightening. The men were in lines, three separate lines, four men to a line, facing André Villiers, who was addressing them. 13 men in all, 12 of them not merely standing, but standing at attention. They were old men, but not merely old men. They were old soldiers. None wore uniforms. Instead, in each lapel they wore ribbons, regimental colors above decorations for valor and rank. And if there was one all-pervasive note about the scene, it, too, was unmistakable. These were men used to command, used to power. It was in their faces, their eyes, in the way they listened. Respect rendered, but not blindly, judgment ever present. Their bodies were old, but there was strength in that room, immense strength. That was the frightening aspect. If these men belonged to Carlos, the assassin's resources were not only far-reaching, they were extraordinarily dangerous. For these were not ordinary men. They were seasoned, professional soldiers. Unless he was grossly mistaken, thought Bourne, the depth of experience and range of influence in that room was staggering. The mad colonels of Algiers. What was left of them? Men driven by memories of a France that no longer existed, a world that was no more, replaced by one they found weak and ineffectual. Such men could make a pact with Carlos, if only for the covert power it gave them. Strike, attack, dispatch. Decisions of life and death that were once a part of their fabric, brought back by a force that could serve causes they refused to admit were no longer viable. Once a terrorist, always a terrorist, and assassination was the raw core of terror. The general was raising his voice. Jason tried to hear the words through the glass. They became clearer.
Our presence will be felt, our purpose understood. We are together in our stand, and that stand is immovable. We shall be heard. In memory of all those who have fallen, our brothers of the tunic and the cannon, who laid down their lives for the glory of France, we shall force our beloved country to remember, and in their names to remain strong, lackey to no one. Those who oppose us will know our anger. In this, too, we are united. We pray to Almighty God that those who have gone before us have found peace, for we are still in conflict. Gentlemen, I give you Our Lady, Our France.
There was a unison of muttered approvals, the old soldiers remaining rigidly at attention. And then another voice was raised, the first five words sung singly, joined at the sixth by the rest of the group.
Allons, enfants de la patrie, le jour de gloire est arrivé.
Bourne turned away, sickened by the sight and the sounds inside that room. Lay waste in the name of glory. The death of fallen comrades perforce demands further death. It is required, and if it means a pact with Carlos, so be it. What disturbed him so? Why was he suddenly swept by feelings of anger and futility? What triggered the revulsion he felt so strongly? And then he knew. He hated a man like André Villiers, despised the men in that room. They were all old men who made war, stealing life from the young and the very young. Why were the mists closing in again? Why was the pain so acute? There was no time for questions, no strength to tolerate them. He had to push them out of his mind and concentrate on André François Villiers, warrior and warlord whose causes belonged to yesterday, but whose pact with an assassin called for death today. He would trap the general, break him, learn everything he knew, and probably kill him. Men like Villiers robbed life from the young and the very young. They did not deserve to live. I am in my labyrinth again, and the walls are embedded with spikes. Oh, God, they hurt. Jason climbed over the railing in the darkness and lowered himself to the drainpipe, each muscle aching. Pain, too, had to be erased. He had to reach a deserted stretch of road in the moonlight and trap a broker of death.
Chapter 25.
Bourne waited in the Renault, 200 yards east of the restaurant entrance, the motor running, prepared to race ahead the instant he saw Villiers drive out. Several others had already left, all in separate cars. Conspirators did not advertise their association, and these old men were conspirators in the truest sense. They had traded whatever honors they had earned for the lethal convenience of an assassin's gun and an assassin's organization. Age and bias had robbed them of reason, as they had spent their lives robbing life from the young and the very young.
What was it? Why won't it leave me? Some terrible thing is deep inside me, trying to break out, trying, I think, to kill me. The fear and the guilt sweep through me. But of what and for what I do not know. Why should these withered old men provoke such feelings of fear and guilt and loathing? They were war. They were death. On the ground and from the skies. From the skies. From the skies. Help me, Marie. For God's sake, help me.
There it was. The headlights swung out of the drive, the long black chassis reflecting the wash of the floodlights. Jason kept his own lights off as he pulled out of the shadows. He accelerated down the road until he reached the first curve, where he switched on the headlights and pressed the pedal to the floor. The isolated stretch in the countryside was roughly 2 miles away. He had to get there quickly. It was 10 past 11, and as 3 hours before, the fields swept into the hills, both bathed in the light of the March moon, now in the center of the sky. He reached the area. It was feasible. The shoulder was wide, bordering a pasture, which meant that both automobiles could be pulled off the road. The immediate objective, however, was to get Villiers to stop. The general was old, but not feeble. If the tactic were suspect, he would break over the grass and race away. Everything was timing, and a totally convincing moment of the unexpected. Bourne swung the Renault around in a U-turn, waited until he saw the headlights in the distance, then suddenly accelerated, swinging the wheel violently back and forth. The automobile careened over the road, an out-of-control driver, incapable of finding a straight line, but nevertheless speeding. Villiers had no choice. He slowed down as Jason came racing insanely toward him. Then abruptly, when the two cars were no more than 20 feet from colliding, Bourne spun the wheel to the left, braking as he did so, sliding into a skid, tires screeching. He came to a stop, the window open, and raised his voice in an undefined cry. Half shout, half scream. It could have been the vocal explosion of an ill man or a drunk man, but the one thing it was not was threatening. He slapped his hand on the frame of the window and was silent, crouching in the seat, his gun on his lap. He heard the door of Villiers' sedan open and peered through the steering wheel. The old man was not visibly armed. He seemed to suspect nothing, relieved only that a collision had been avoided. The general walked through the beams of the headlights to the Renault's left window, his shouts anxious, his French the interrogating commands of Saint-Cyr.
"What's the meaning of this? What do you think you're doing? Are you all right?"
His hands gripped the base of the window. "Yes, but you're not," replied Bourne in English, raising the gun.
"What?"
the old man gasped, standing erect.
"Who are you, and what is this?"
Jason got out of the Renault, his left hand extended above the barrel of the weapon. "I'm glad your English is fluent. Walk back to your car. Drive it off the road."
"And if I refuse?"
"I'll kill you right now. It wouldn't take much to provoke me."
"Do these words come from the Red Brigades, or the Paris branch of the Bader-Meinhof?"
"Why, could you countermand them if they did?"
"I spit at them. And you."
"No one's ever doubted your courage, General. Walk to your car."
"It's not a matter of courage," said Villiers without moving. "It's a question of logic. You'll accomplish nothing by killing me, less by kidnapping me. My orders are firm, fully understood by my staff and my family. The Israelis are absolutely right. There can be no negotiations with terrorists. Use your gun, garbage, or get out of here."
Jason studied the old soldier, suddenly, profoundly uncertain, but not about to be fooled. It would be in the furious eyes that stared at him. One name soaked in filth, coupled with another name heaped with the honors of his nation, would cause another kind of explosion. It would be in the eyes. "Back at that restaurant, you said France shouldn't be a lackey to anyone. But a general of France became someone's lackey. General André Villiers, messenger for Carlos. Carlos contact, Carlos soldier, Carlos lackey." The furious eyes did grow wide, but not in any way Jason expected. Fury was suddenly joined by hatred. Not shock, not hysteria, but deep, uncompromising abhorrence. The back of Villiers' hand shot up, arching from his waist, the crack against Bourne's face sharp, accurate, painful. It was followed by a forward slap, brutal, insulting, the force of the blow reeling Jason back on his feet. The old man moved in, blocked by the barrel of the gun, but unafraid, undeterred by its presence, consumed only with inflicting punishment. The blows came one after another, delivered by a man possessed.
"Pig!" screamed Villiers. "Filthy, detestable pig! Garbage! I'll shoot! I'll kill you! Stop it!"
But Bourne could not pull the trigger. He was backed into the small car, his shoulders pressed against the roof. Still the old man attacked, his hands flying out, swinging up, crashing down.
Kill me if you can, if you dare. Dirt. Filth.
Jason threw the gun to the ground, raising his arms to fend off Villiers' assault. He lashed his left hand out, grabbing the old man's right wrist, then his left, gripping the left forearm that was slashing down like a broadsword. He twisted both violently, bending Villiers into him, forcing the old soldier to stand motionless, their faces inches from each other, the old man's chest heaving.
Are you telling me you're not Carlos, man? Are you denying it?
Villiers lunged forward, trying to break Bourne's grip, his barrel-like chest smashing into Jason.
I revile you. Animal. God damn you. Yes or no?
The old man spat in Bourne's face, the fire in his eyes now clouded, tears welling.
Carlos killed my son, he said in a whisper. He killed my only son on the Rue de Bac. My son's life was blown up with 5 sticks of dynamite on the Rue de Bac.
Jason slowly reduced the pressure of his fingers. Breathing heavily, he spoke as calmly as he could.
Drive your car into the field and stay there. We have to talk, General. Something's happened you don't know about, and we'd both better learn what it is. Never. Impossible. It could not happen.
It happened, said Bourne, sitting with Villiers in the front seat of the sedan.
An incredible mistake has been made. You don't know what you're saying.
No mistake. And I do know what I'm saying because I found the number myself. It's not only the right number, it's a magnificent cover. Nobody in his right mind would connect you with Carlos, especially in light of your son's death. Is it common knowledge he was Carlos Kill?
I would prefer different language, monsieur.
Sorry. I mean that.
Common knowledge? Among the Sûreté?
A qualified, yes.
Within military intelligence and Interpol, most certainly.
I read the reports.
What did they say? It was presumed that Carlos did a favor for his friends from his radical days, even to the point of allowing them to appear silently responsible for the act. It was politically motivated, you know. My son was a sacrifice, an example to others who opposed the fanatics.
Fanatics?
The extremists were forming a false coalition with the socialists, making promises they had no intention of keeping. My son understood this, exposed it, and initiated legislation to block the alignment. He was killed for it.
Is that why you retired from the army and stood for election?
With all my heart. It is customary for the son to carry on for the father.
The old man paused, the moonlight illuminating his haggard face.
In this matter, it was the father's legacy to carry on for the son. He was no soldier, nor I a politician, but I am no stranger to weapons and explosives. His causes were molded by me. His philosophy reflected my own, and he was killed for these things. My decision was clear to me. I would carry on our beliefs into the political arena and let his enemies contend with me. The soldier was prepared for them.
More than one soldier, I gather.
What do you mean?
Those men back there at the restaurant. They looked like they ran half the armies in France.
They did, monsieur. They were once known as the angry young commanders of Saint-Cyr. The Republic was corrupt, the military incompetent, the Maginot a joke. Had they been heeded in their time, France would not have fallen. They became the leaders of the resistance. They fought the Boche and Vichy all through Europe and Africa.
What do they do now?
Most live on pensions, many obsessed with the past. they pray to the Virgin that it will never be repeated. In too many areas, however, they see it happening. The military is reduced to a sideshow, communists and socialists in the assembly forever eroding the strength of the services. The Moscow apparatus runs true to form. It does not change with the decades. A free society is ripe for infiltration, and once infiltrated, the changes do not stop until that society is remade into another image. Conspiracy is everywhere. It cannot go unchallenged. Some might say that sounds pretty extreme itself. For what? Survival? Strength? Honor? Are these terms too anachronistic for you? I don't think so. But I can imagine a lot of damage being done in their names. Our philosophies differ, and I don't care to debate them. You asked me about my associates, and I answered you. Now please, this incredible misinformation of yours. It's appalling. You don't know what it's like to lose a son, to have a child killed. The pain comes back to me, and I don't know why. Pain and emptiness, a vacuum in the sky. From the sky. Death in and from the skies. Jesus, it hurts. It... what is it? I can sympathize, said Jason, his hands gripped to stop the sudden trembling. But it fits. Not for an instant. As you said, no one in his right mind would connect me to Carlos, least of all the killer pig himself. It's a risk he would not take. It's unthinkable. Exactly. Which is why you're being used. It is unthinkable. You're the perfect relay for final instructions. Impossible. How? Someone at your phone is in direct contact with Carlos. Codes are used, certain words spoken to get that person on the phone. Probably when you're not there, possibly when you are. Do you answer the telephone yourself? Villiers frowned. Actually, I don't. Not that number. There are too many people to be avoided, and I have a private line. Who does answer it? Generally the housekeeper, or her husband, who serves as part butler, part chauffeur. He was my driver during my last years in the army. If not either of them, my wife, of course. Or my aide, who often works at my office at the house. He was my adjutant for 20 years. Who else? There is no one else. Maids? Non-permanent. If they are needed, they are hired for an occasion. There's more wealth in the Villiers names than in the banks. Cleaning woman? 2. They come twice a week, and not always the same 2. You'd better take a closer look at your chauffeur and the adjutant. Preposterous. Their loyalty is beyond question. So was Brutus, and Caesar outranked you. You can't be serious. I'm goddamn serious. And you'd better believe it. Everything I've told you is the truth. Well, then you haven't really told me very much, have you? Your name, for instance. It's not necessary. Knowing it could only hurt you. In what way? In the very remote chance that I'm wrong about the relay. And that possibility barely exists. The old man nodded the way old men do when repeating words that have stunned them to the point of disbelief. His lined face moved up and down in the moonlight. An unnamed man traps me on a road at night, holds me under a gun, and makes an obscene accusation. A charge so filthy I wish to kill him. And he expects me to accept his word. The word of a man without a name, with no face I recognize, and no credentials offered other than the statement that Carlos is hunting him. Tell me why should I believe this man? Because, answered Bourne, he'd have no reason to come to you if he didn't believe it was the truth. Villiers stared at Jason. No,
There's a better reason. A while ago, you gave me my life. You threw down your gun. You did not fire it. You could have, easily. You chose instead to plead with me to talk. I don't think I pleaded. It was in your eyes, young man. It's always in the eyes, and often in the voice, but one must listen carefully. Supplication can be feigned, not anger. It is either real or it's a posture. Your anger was real, as was mine. The old man gestured toward the small Renault 10 yards away in the field. Follow me back to Portmanteau. We'll talk further in my office. I'd swear on my life that you're wrong about both men. But then, as you pointed out, Caesar was blinded by false devotion. And indeed he did outrank me. If I walk into that house and someone recognizes me, I'm dead. So are you. My aide left shortly past 5 o'clock this afternoon, and the chauffeur, as you call him, retires no later than 10 to watch his interminable television. You'll wait outside while I go in and check. If things are normal, I'll summon you. If they're not, I'll come back out and drive away. Follow me again. I'll stop somewhere and we'll continue. Jason watched closely as Villiers spoke. Why do you want me to go back to Portmanteau? Where else? I believe in the shock of unexpected confrontation. One of those men is lying in bed watching television in a room on the 3rd floor. And there's another reason. I want my wife to hear what you have to say. She's an old soldier's woman, and she has antennae for things that often escape the officer in the field. I've come to rely on her perceptions. She may recognize a pattern of behavior once she hears you. Bourne had to say the words. I trapped you by pretending one thing. You can trap me by pretending another. How do I know Portmanteau isn't a trap? The old man did not waver. You have the word of a general officer of France, and that's all you have. If it's not good enough for you, take your weapon and get out. It's good enough, said Bourne. Not because it's a general's word, but because it's the word of a man whose son was killed in the Rue de Bac. The drive back into Paris seemed far longer to Jason than the journey out. He was fighting images again, images that caused him to break out into sweat. And pain, starting at his temples, sweeping down through his chest, forming a knot in his stomach, sharp bolts pounding until he wanted to scream. Death in the skies. From the skies. Not darkness, but blinding sunlight. No winds that batter my body into further darkness, but instead silence and the stench of jungle and riverbanks. Stillness followed by the screeching of birds and the screaming pitch of machines. Birds. Machines. Racing downward out of the sky in blinding sunlight. Explosions. Death. Of the young and the very young. Stop it. Hold the wheel. Concentrate on the road, but do not think. Thought is too painful, and you don't know why. They entered the tree-lined street in Portmanteau. Villiers was 100 feet ahead, facing a problem that had not existed several hours ago. There were many more automobiles in the street now, parking at a premium. There was, however, one sizable space on the left, across from the general's house. It could accommodate both their cars. Villiers thrust his hand out the window, gesturing for Jason to pull in behind him. And then it happened. Jason's eyes were drawn by a light in a doorway, his focus suddenly rigid on the figures in the spill. The recognition of one so startling and so out of place, he found himself reaching for the gun in his belt. Had he been led into a trap after all? Had the word of a general officer of France been worthless? Villiers was maneuvering his sedan into place. Bourne spun around in the seat, looking in all directions. There was no one coming toward him, no one closing in. It was not a trap.
It was something else, part of what was happening about which the old soldier knew nothing. For across the street and up the steps of Villiers' house stood a youngish woman, a striking woman, in the doorway. She was talking rapidly, with small anxious gestures, to a man standing on the top step, who kept nodding as if accepting instructions. That man was the gray-haired, distinguished-looking switchboard operator from Les Classiques. The man whose face Jason knew so well, yet did not know. The face that had triggered other images. Images as violent and as painful as those which had ripped him apart during the past half hour in the Renault. But there was a difference. This face brought back the darkness and torrential winds in the night sky, explosions coming one after another, sounds of a staccato gunfire echoing through the myriad tunnels of a jungle. Bourne pulled his eyes away from the door and looked at Villiers through the windshield. The general had switched off his headlights and was about to get out of the car. Jason released the clutch and rolled forward until he made contact with the sedan's bumper. Villiers whipped around in his seat. Bourne extinguished his own headlights and turned on the small inside roof light. He raised his hand, palm downward, then raised it twice again, telling the old soldier to stay where he was. Villiers nodded, and Jason switched off the light. He looked back over at the doorway. The man had taken a step down, stopped by a last command from the woman. Bourne could see her clearly now. She was in her middle to late 30s, with short dark hair, stylishly cut, framing a face that was bronzed by the sun. She was a tall woman, statuesque actually, her figure tapered, the swell of her breasts accentuated by the sheer, close-fitting fabric of a long white dress that heightened the tan of her skin. If she was part of the house, Villiers had not mentioned her, which meant she was not. She was a visitor who knew when to come to the old man's home. It would fit the strategy of relay removed from relay. And that meant she had a contact in Villiers' house. The old man had to know her, but how well? The answer, obviously, was not well enough. The gray-haired switchboard operator gave a final nod, descended the steps, and walked rapidly down the block. The door closed, the light of the carriage lamps shining on the deserted staircase and the glistening black door with the brass hardware. Why did those steps and that door mean something to him? Images. Reality that was not real. Bourne got out of the Renault, watching the windows, looking for the movement of a curtain. There was nothing. He walked quickly to Villiers' car. The front window was rolled down, the general's face turned up, his thick eyebrows arched in curiosity. "What in heaven's name are you doing?" he asked. "Over there, at your house," said Jason, crouching on the pavement. "You saw what I just saw."
"I believe so." "And?"
"Who was the woman? Do you know her?"
"I would hope to God I did. She's my wife."
"Your wife?" Bourne's shock was on his face.
I thought you said she was an old woman. That you wanted her to listen to me because over the years you'd learned to respect her judgment. In the field, you said. That's what you said.
"Not exactly. I said she was an old soldier's woman. And I do indeed respect her judgment. But she's my second wife. My very much younger second wife, but every bit as devoted as my first, who died 8 years ago."
"Oh, my God."
"Don't let the disparity of our ages concern you. She is proud and happy to be the second, Madame Villiers. She's been a great help to me in the assembly."
"I'm sorry," whispered Bourne. "Christ, I'm sorry."
"What about? You mistook her for someone else? People frequently do. She's a stunning girl. I'm quite proud of her." Villiers opened the door as Jason stood up on the pavement. "You wait here," said the general. "I'll go inside and check. If everything's normal, I'll open the door and signal you. If it isn't, I'll come back to the car and we'll drive away."
Bourne remained motionless in front of Villiers, preventing the old man from stepping forward. "General, I've got to ask you something. I'm not sure how, but I have to."
I told you I found your number at a relay drop used by Carlos. I didn't tell you where, only that it was confirmed by someone who admitted passing messages to and from contacts of Carlos. Bourne took a breath, his eyes briefly on the door across the street. Now, I've got to ask you a question, and please think carefully before you answer. Does your wife buy clothes at a shop called Les Classiques?
In Saint-Honoré?
Yes.
I happen to know she does not.
Are you sure?
Very much so. Not only have I never seen a bill from there, but she's told me how much she dislikes its designs. My wife is very knowledgeable in matters of fashion.
Oh, Jesus.
What?
General, I can't go inside that house. No matter what you find, I can't go in there.
Why not? What are you saying?
The man on the steps who was talking to your wife. He's from the drop. It's Les Classiques. He's a contact to Carlos. The blood drained from André Villiers' face. He turned and stared across the tree-lined street at his house, at the glistening black door and the brass fittings that reflected the light of the carriage lamps. The pockmarked beggar scratched the stubble of his beard, took off his threadbare beret, and trudged through the bronze doors of the small church in Neuilly-sur-Seine. He walked down the far right aisle under the disapproving glances of two priests. Both clerics were upset. This was a wealthy parish, and biblical compassion notwithstanding, wealth did have its privileges. One of them was to maintain a certain status of worshipper, for the benefit of other worshippers, and this elderly, disheveled derelict hardly fit the mold. The beggar made a feeble attempt to genuflect, sat down in a pew in the second row, crossed himself and knelt forward, his head in prayer, his right hand pushing back the left sleeve of his overcoat. On his wrist was a watch somewhat in contradistinction to the rest of his apparel. It was an expensive digital, the numbers large and the readout bright. It was a possession he would never be foolish enough to part with, for it was a gift from Carlos. He had once been 25 minutes late for confession, upsetting his benefactor, and had no other excuse but the lack of an accurate timepiece. During their next appointment, Carlos had pushed it beneath the translucent scrim separating sinner from holy man. It was the hour and the minute. The beggar rose and walked toward the second booth on the right. He parted the curtain and went inside.
Angelus Domini.
Angelus Domini, child of God. The whisper from behind the black cloth was harsh.
Are your days comfortable? They are made comfortable.
Very well, interrupted the silhouette.
What did you bring me? My patience draws to an end. I pay thousands, hundreds of thousands, for incompetence and failure. What happened in Montrouge? Who was responsible for the lies that came from the embassy in the Montagne? Who accepted them? The Auberge du Coin was a trap, yet not one for killing. It is difficult to know exactly what it was. If the attaché named Corbelier repeated lies, our people are convinced he was not aware of it. He was duped by the woman. He was duped by Cain. Bourne traces each source, feeding each false information.